Okay, so today we're only going to go to 7 p.m. because Pixar is here and we want to make sure that you're able to get out early enough. So we're going to cut it a little bit early at 7. And then I'm only going to talk for hopefully maybe 10 or 15 minutes. I just want to look at Matrix Multiply. Now that we learned about shared memory and synchronization, let's go revisit Matrix Multiply and really improve the algorithm, both improve how generally useful it is and also improve its performance. I have a feeling that my talk will be boring compared to Carl, who is going to talk about parallel path tracing, which will be really useful for the ray tracer that you guys are working on now, and I think will also be incredibly useful for the path tracer that you will write immediately after your ray tracer. The other thing, and I don't know if I've been explicit about this in class yet, but in the first half of the semester, you guys are going to write the GPU ray tracer, path tracer, and rasterizer. And I want you guys to be excited and feel good about this because I know of no other course in the world at any university where students would write all three of those in a semester, let alone in half of a semester. So we're looking forward to you guys doing really good with that. Okay, so with that said, let's just go back over Matrix Multiply. So up here is our CPU implementation, and we notice that it's n cubed, and the innermost loop computes a dot product that's finding one element for p, which is the output, and is taking a row of n and a column of n, and it's doing the dot product. And we looked at that, and we said, well, geez, there's a lot of data level parallelism here because every dot product can be done in parallel, and it's embarrassingly parallel. So we said this is a nice problem to put on the GPU. And then we looked at a naive kernel, CUDA kernel, for putting it on the GPU, where basically the outer two for loops that went over each element in the matrix got replaced with a kernel launch, and then each thread in the kernel computed one dot product. And here we're just using the thread index to know what element, what output element we're going to compute. And then we do a loop that accumulates the dot product for this particular element. And again, everyone knows the outer two for loops are gone because when we did the kernel launch, it's kind of implicit. And no locks or synchronization because we are not, everything is independent of everything else. There's no write conflicts. There's no collaboration for reading in the shared memory. None of that. It's just bread and butter. You know, we love problems like this. It's so easy to get started with it. But we are using global memory. The input M and N matrices are in global memory, and then the output P matrix is in global memory. So that is one of the problems, is the global memory. The other problem is that we're just using one block, and we're limited. In this case, I'd say the limiting factor is the number of threads you can put in the block, and therefore we're limited with the size matrix that we could do with our initial algorithm. So we're going to drop both of these, the performance limitation and then the feature limitation. We're going to get rid of both of these using techniques that we learned on Monday that I think should be pretty straightforward from the discussion that we had on Monday. Okay, so first, let's just remove the size limitation. We want to be able to do arbitrarily sized matrices. So to do that, we're going to split the matrix up into blocks or tiles. You know, you'd call this tiled matrix multiply. But all we're really doing is breaking up into blocks, and then we're going to launch a grid that has a 2D set of blocks, and each block does a tile of the of the output matrix. And then we're, instead of indexing with just thread index, we'll index with both block index and thread index. So it's just an extra multiply. So here's a simple example where we're looking at a 4x4 matrix that we're gonna output where the tile size is 2x2. So this is a trivial case. We wouldn't have tile sizes this small, but for just looking at it in PowerPoint, this is a reasonable size. And so each block in the grid will be responsible for a 2x2 region here. So here's an example where we have one block and it's completing the 2x2 tile in the upper left-hand corner. And I just want you to observe for the moment here that each one still does, you know, full dot product, taking a column from M and then a row from, a row from M on the left and then a column from N at the top. Okay, so here's the code. In fact, it is a lot more concise than our original code, mainly because I removed a lot of temporary variables. The original code is straight out of your book. This is code that I resized to fit PowerPoint. Although you could write it just like this. It's up to you if you think it's more clear or less clear. But the only real difference here is that you'll see that when we try to figure out what our output element is, we're going to use both the block index and the block dimension. So we're not just using thread index, because we need to skip over every other block to get to our local block. And we'll look at the kernel launch in a second here. And then that's it. It's the same as before. We still accumulate one dot product. We're still going to read from the entire M and N input matrices. And then here's the launch where we just say, okay, we picked our tile width. For example, say 16 is a good one for the G80. And then we go, okay, well, our total width is width, our total height is height, and then we just do the division. And again, yes, in this example, I'm assuming that width and height are evenly divisible by tile width here. Launch the kernel, and that's it. Very small change now, and we've went from a single block to using many blocks that we can handle matrices of arbitrary sizes, assuming that it fits into the GPU's global memory, right, which is... a high-end GPU today is probably 6 gigs, I would say, 6 gigs. Okay, but we're still accessing global memory. We're accessing a lot of global memory, and that ultimately is going to slow us down. Because for code to run fast on the GPU, we need something that's data parallel, where we can do all these computations in parallel, but we also want something that has a high compute-to-memory read ratio, and right now we're reading... the ratio is basically 1-to-1. So here are some numbers. For the G80, which is the original card that could do CUDA, the peak gigaflops that would be theoretical, but you could write code that can achieve it, is 346 gigaflops. The problem is right now, since we're going to global memory, we don't have enough bandwidth to feed the compute. Okay, so we would need 1,300 gigabytes per second to achieve this gigaflops, given the current compute to memory ratio. But we only have a bandwidth of 86.4 on the G80. Now, on more recent cards, that number's a little bit higher, say 150 or 170. But even still, it's not enough. So what this winds up doing is it limits our code all the way down to 21.6 gigaflops. Right, so on the first day, or maybe the second day of class, one thing we said, gigaflops. Okay, it's interesting to see, or even teraflops, what's the theoretical compute performance of a card, but do we always achieve it? And one of the reasons that we don't always achieve it is because of memory access. And in this case, the memory access is drowning us down to what's in practice is only 15 gigaflops, which is much less than the theoretical maximum of 346.5, right? So it's like, I thought I was going to get this performance with my code, and then you're an order of magnitude under it. So what we really want to do here is drastically reduce going to global memory so that we're not bound by the memory anymore, so that we can really utilize the compute that's there. Okay, so all we're going to do is use shared memory. We're going to bring data from global memory that's slow into shared memory that's fast, and we're going to make threads work together so that they each one of them will bring in an element from M and an element from N, and then once they bring it into shared memory, they can all use the data they brought in the shared memory. And this is very common technique that you'll see. We're doing it here with matrix multiply, but it could be collision detection. It is very common to have a bunch of threads, each bring some data from global memory into shared memory, and then synchronize, and then once they all synchronize, they go, okay, well, anyone can use any part of the shared memory that we brought in. So I just want to be really clear, because sometimes I think I may be a little ambiguous, and the literature is also ambiguous. Like when we say memory and memory bandwidth is a problem, we're always talking about global memory. Like going to global memory is really slow. you know, hundreds of cycles, like 300 cycles is a decent number to have in your head as a mental model. Shared memory is very fixed. You're looking, say, 2 cycles. On the G80, it's 2 cycles. So just so we're clear about that. So, okay. So here's what we're going to do now. Is we're going to break the kernel up, and instead of the kernel doing one dot product straight through, where it just takes, you know, the row from N and the column from N and accumulate this dot product, we're going to break it up into phases where we're going to do just a we're going to take a tile from M and a tile from N, and we're going to do the dot product just on that subset. And then once we do that, we're going to move on to another tile, and we're going to accumulate the dot product over multiple phases, and each phase has really good data locality. So for example, we're computing all the elements in this tile here. And if we start blasting through the row and blasting down the column, the data locality is not very good. It's all over the place. But if instead we just do a subset from M and a subset from N, we can keep the data locality really good so we can utilize shared memory. And you'll see the code tweaks that we're going to do are actually really small. They're careful, but it's not a lot of code. Okay, so let's jump down and look at the code here. So this is it. This is the complete implementation here for the kernel. Okay, so first thing you're going to see is the shared memory declaration here. And you'll see __shared__. So that is saying that these two arrays that we're declaring here, one for M and one for N, these are 2D arrays that are in shared memory. So any thread in the block can access this. But they're going to have to synchronize so that when they access it, you get the data that you think, or you don't overwrite data that you don't want to overwrite. But that's how you declare shared memory, as we discussed a little bit on Monday. Okay, so now what I want to point out here is the for loop for accumulating the dot product doesn't just go, you know, from zero to width, or, you know, less than width. Instead, we're going for each tile. Okay, so you see here, width divided by tile, that's basically the number of blocks that are in the grid for launching. The first thing that we do is we're going to bring in an element from M and an element from N into shared memory. Then we're going to sync threads, which means that every other thread in the block needs to get to this exact line of code, this sync threads. Okay, then the good news is once they all get here, everyone has brought in one element from M and one element from N inside this tile that we're doing the subset of the dot product for. So at this point, after this first sync threads, we can do the for loop down the bottom for k to equal 0 while k is less than tile width. And there we can accumulate the subset of the dot product just for that tile, all in shared memory. Okay, so there's no global memory access there. Now tell me, why do you guys think we have these second sync threads down here? Hopefully, first tell me, is it clear? Is everyone comfortable with the first sync threads and why we need it? Right, because we're bringing data in the shared memory, and then afterwards we're using the data in shared memory, but we're not just using the data in shared memory that our thread brought in, we're using the data that every thread in our block brought in. Hence, you see the for loop here where k varies, right? Our thread didn't necessarily bring that data. Every thread in our block brought in the data. So we need to synchronize. We need to say, okay, everyone do your read. And then when we have it, we can continue. But this sync threads is less obvious. I promise that it's not a trick question. You do need it. But why do you think we need it? Synchronize with a different tile. So we can't do that, right? Because each tile is a separate block, and we can't use shared memory or sync threads to synchronize those blocks. They might not even be on the same processor, right? Good thinking, though. So tell me, okay, let's just say we took it out. What happens on the next iteration of the outer for loop?
The memory when you're getting the memory before the first inference, that could cause some issues maybe.
So before the first, does everyone agree that at the top of the for loop that we're writing to shared memory, right? Everyone would say the first two lines inside the outer for loop are writing to shared memory. Now, the inner for loop is reading from that shared memory. Okay, so say I didn't have this bottom sync threads. And we have some threads, and they're in this for loop, the K for loop, the inner for loop, and they're reading from shared memory. But what if other threads went into the second iteration of the outermost loop, and there's no sync threads? Do you see that they could write shared memory? They could be on the second iteration of that outermost loop. They could write the shared memory that we still think is good for our tile for the dot product. Do you guys see that?
Yep. I have a couple of questions. Firstly, because sync threads is inside a for loop which has a condition, is there a possibility of it stopping?
Is there a possibility of anything like crashing here?
Yes. You're,
or not crashing, sorry. Deadlocking? What do you think?
That comes to my second question. What if the width does not the same for the matrices? Because it can be different, right?
Sure. So good question. So in this code, the width is always the same. We've decided that, you know, we're just doing square matrices that are all, they're, you know, power of two, that are just everything that we want to make this code simple and easy to explain. So in this code, that will never happen. And do you also agree with me that these sync threads will always execute? Each thread will execute the same number of sync threads as well, because there's no conditions here that are dependent on the particular thread. They're all dependent on higher level variables that all threads have the same values of. Good. Other questions on this? Yep.
Is it okay for us to like to put the sync threads, the statements at the beginning of the outer loop instead of the end?
At the beginning of the outer for loop? Oh, yes. The only reason that you wouldn't want to do that is there going to be an extra sync threads? No, you know, it's going to be the same number of sync threads, right? Let me think. Yeah, I think that that's completely reasonable. I think that it's equivalent in terms of it's going to work, and in terms of performance, I think it's going to be exactly the same. I'm pretty sure I'll say it'll be exactly the same. Yes. Other questions? So everyone will do this at some point. You might not do matrix multiply because we're going to do stuff that's more fun, like path tracing. But everyone's going to be using shared memory and then using sync threads to coordinate reading that memory and using it. I promise you that. And this is like the, you know, this is how you get your code to go 10 times faster. Like, you know, you'll see dramatic improvements. And I hope that you do see dramatic improvements when you when you're working on your projects. Okay, so, and then remember, the final answer, of course, we're putting back to global memory, right? Because the P matrix that's the output is in global memory. Okay, so just one or two more slides, and we're going to let Carl take over. So we got to be careful picking tile width. In general, we always got to be careful picking block sizes. Right, so we can't exceed the maximum number of threads in a block, so that's one limiting factor, which and the G80 we've been talking about is 512. We also can't exceed shared memory limitations. Again, on the G80, you're looking at 16K per processor, per SM, and up to 8 blocks. So if you were just to go, okay, I'm going to do 8 blocks, that's 2K per block, so 1K for each of the input for the M and N that we keep in shared memory. So if you were to increase that tile width, you're going to have less shared memory per block, right? Then overall, you'll have less warps for scheduling. So when you look, if you were to analyze this code here, what you'd see is that we reduce global memory access by a factor of tile width. So if you're doing 16 by 16 tiles in shared memory, you reduce it by a factor of 16. And now what you'll see with this matrix multiply is we almost get the maximum gigaflops on G80. And the compute ratio of compute to global memory access, not shared memory, turns out to be 16, I would think it's 16 to 1 now instead of 1 to 1. So I just really want to emphasize, like, use shared memory to reduce going to global memory and carefully synchronize your threads, right? The sync threads is a lightweight barrier. Every thread gets to it, then anyone can move on. And, okay, we pretty much beat this to death. We don't need to go over this. So I want to stop there. The rest of these slides have atomics on them, which we'll see is a way to have blocks communicate with each other through global memory. Atomics are useful. I want you to use them sparingly, though. And we'll talk about them probably in a few lectures from now, because I really want Carl to do his path tracing stuff today and Wednesday, because that's going to be so useful for your projects. Remember, like, the only thing that I care about is your projects. And then we have a guest lecture a week from Monday on GPU search. So we will come back to atomics, but don't worry. We won't put you in a position where you need to use them before we talk about them. So any questions on the matrix multiply and the tile technique with shared memory? Great, okay. Carl, it's all yours, and here's your slides.
Cool, thank you. Okay, so how many of you guys have forked the Project 1 repo and taken a look at what the project is? Yes, no? Okay, well, for those of you who haven't looked at it yet, how do we full screen this? Cool. Okay, so the Project 1 is to build a parallel ray tracer. So for everyone who took 460, which should be all of you, or not most of you, you've already implemented a ray tracer. However, there are some significant hurdles when you want to translate a recursive ray tracer into a parallel ray tracer that it runs in CUDA. And then those same challenges apply to path tracing. So we're going to go over that today and Wednesday. And we're going to begin by just doing a very quick overview and sort of introduction and theory review for ray tracing, path tracing, global illumination rendering, that kind of stuff. It's all stuff that you've covered in 460, 560, so we're just going to breeze over that fairly quickly. And then we're going to go into the details and nitty-gritty of actually implementing the parallel ray tracer, which is the first step in building a parallel path tracer, which we'll go into the details for on Wednesday. Okay, so yeah, quick introduction and theory review for path tracing. Okay, so this is the rendering equation. As you know from 560, once again, the rendering equation is simply a mathematical expression that describes the solution for global illumination inside of a given scene. It looks like really complicated, scary math, but when you break it down, it's actually fairly simple. It simply says that the outgoing light for a given point is equal to the incoming light plus the amount of light emitted from that point. Minus absorbed light. So first term is outgoing light, second term is emitted light, and then you want to integrate over a hemisphere in the direction W over a given point P. So let's say that you have a surface and you have a point. You're just creating a hemisphere over that point that's centered on a normal, and you're integrating all the light coming from within this hemisphere. So you integrate over that. The term immediately after the integral is the BRDF, bidirectional reflectance distribution function. We'll go into what that is. Basically, it defines how light interacts with the surface. Next term is incoming light, again, coming in from all directions. So we're integrating over that hemisphere. And then cosine theta is an attenuation term. Basically, light coming in at this angle doesn't have as much of a contribution as light coming in from this angle. Again, we'll look at that. We'll look at this more in detail on Wednesday, because this is more related to the path tracer. So the rendering equation, you can basically split it into two components, which is the direct contribution and the indirect contribution. So path tracing is a solution for both the direct contribution and indirect contribution. And then ray tracing represents just the direct contribution. So you can think of it as ray tracing kind of solves half of this problem. So we'll go into more detail about what the BRDF is. BRDF is a bidirectional reflectance distribution function, kind of a mouthful. So basically, it defines how light interacts with an opaque surface. When you shine light onto a surface, it scatters off in some way. And a BRDF is a function that describes that. And you know, different surfaces and different materials will have different BRDF functions. But BRDF functions are all, you know, they're all five-dimensional, and they, very simply, they take an array and tell you, given this incoming ray, a normal and some other information, what's the outgoing ray? And there's a couple of very simple reflectance models that we'll be focusing on inside of our path tracer. We'll be focusing on ideal specular, so you can think of ideal specular as basically purely reflective, like a mirror. We'll look at ideal diffuse, which you can think of as wall paint. We won't cover this today, but we'll also take a quick look at specular glossy surfaces, so kind of like things that are somewhere in between pure diffuse and pure reflection. So you know, Phong model, microfacet model, torrent spiral model. We'll go over those on Wednesday. So the ideal specular case is pretty self-explanatory. Incoming light and outgoing light make the same angle across the surface, so it's just pure reflection. Something goes, hits a mirror, comes back. And then there are slight variances in how this behaves due to Fresnel's law, which defines the behavior of light when it moves between different mediums with different indices of refraction. Schlick's approximation is a mathematical, like a quick and dirty mathematical approximation that's used a lot in computer graphics to approximate Fresnel's law, since the actual implementation can get kind of hairy. Once again, stuff we'll go over on Wednesday. Trying to get to the ray tracing stuff pretty quickly. Ideal diffuse is probably the simplest sort of reflectance model. It's just light hits the surface and goes off in any other direction. In fact, light is equally likely to go off in any output direction along this hemisphere. And once again, think wall paint. So wall paint has no reflection whatsoever. It's basically just a flat color, and that's what diffuse is. And there's a couple of theoretical models for this. There's like fancy microfacet models and subsurface reflection models, but we're just going to do like a really simple Lambert cosine implementation. Okay, so solving the actual rendering equation requires using path tracing, which is this word that we've been throwing around. Path tracing, so this is the kind of really pretty image you can generate with path tracing, since it represents a complete lighting solution. Just like in real life, you can produce these highly realistic, high-quality images. So path tracing itself, it's actually just an extension of ray tracing. And it's an extension of specifically of something called distributed ray tracing, which allows you to get fancy stuff like depth of field and soft shadows. And basically, distributed ray tracing just means you're ray tracing an image multiple times with slight variances between each iteration, and you accumulate them to get a final image, which is your final result. This, we'll go into this again. I know I'm saying this a lot. We'll go over this on Wednesday. It's known as the like Monte Carlo integration, which the basic idea of Monte Carlo integration is just you can converge to a solution for a problem by continuously randomly sampling all the different possible solutions within a space, and eventually you'll converge to the most probable solution, which is the right one. As you can guess, continuously randomly sampling all the different possible ways you could ray trace a scene can be very, very, very slow. And this technique was proposed in 1986, along with the original rendering equation paper, but it's only been implemented in the past couple of years, because only in the past couple of years has CPU hardware become sufficiently powerful to be able to do this in any sort of reasonable time frame. So the path tracing algorithm is very simple. You start off with basic ray tracing. For each pixel inside of an image, you shoot a ray from the camera through that pixel into your scene. And then for each ray, you trace it until it hits a surface. And then when you hit a surface, you sample both the emittance, the amount of light that surface is putting out, and the BRDF for the surface. And you use that to determine, one, how strong the light contribution of that ray is, and two, what the direction of that ray is, like what direction the ray bounces off in. and you continue tracing this ray, and you allow it to bounce around the scene, and you accumulate admittances and colors until some maximum recursion depth is reached, and then you terminate it. And then you repeat this step over and over and over and over and over and over until your image finally converges. Because if you think about the diffuse case, every time a ray of light comes in, it's going off in a random direction, which means every single iteration, you're going to have a slightly different result for where that ray is going, which means the pixel value you get back is different. And the actual true pixel value, since it has to be an integration over all the possible directions inside of this hemisphere, it can be thought of as just taking all of these iterations, adding them up, and dividing by the total amount. There's some probability weighting that's to go on if you have like a more fancy implementation, but in the implementation we're doing, which is just a brute force, unbiased, unweighted solution, this is sufficient. So how slow is slow? So this is what you get after one iteration of path tracing. As you can see, you're starting to get a sense of what the scene looks like, but it's very, very noisy. You're getting a lot of Monte Carlo noise and stuff. After 20 iterations, it smooths out a little more. After 250 iterations, it smooths out more, but it's still not perfectly smooth. This is very, very slow on the CPU. Which is why we want to move it to the GPU. Because it turns out, even with a really naive implementation, GPU path tracing can converge significantly faster. In fact, fast enough in some cases to be interactive. So we're talking, you know, sub-second as opposed to minutes to hours. And the reason that we can do this is because path tracing is a naively parallel problem, which we'll look at. And then if you implement, you know, fancy things like stackless KD trees and acceleration structures and important sampling, all that stuff lends a huge performance boost to the CPU side or version, which means it lends an even bigger performance boost to the GPU version. And that makes it just go even faster. So by putting it onto the GPU, we can effectively get around this brute force compute problem. However, we still have a memory problem. As we all know, and as Patrick has gone over, the single biggest constraint on the GPU is both memory available and memory bandwidth. Since path tracing requires keeping everything inside of your scene in memory, that's a lot of geometry that has to be in memory at the same time. And that's not a problem usually on the CPU, because usually on the host you can have 16, 32 gigabytes of memory and nobody cares. But you know, even top-end graphics cards today usually only come with like 1.5, 2 gigs of memory. If you have a really expensive Quattro card, maybe you get 6 gigs of memory, but not everybody has that. So these are just some demonstration renders from current commercial GPU path tracers. The leading one right now is called Brigade, and then there's another one called Arion, and there's another one called Octane. These are kind of the three big commercial path tracing efforts right now. This is a video of how quick Brigade is. Okay, so this is a game engine that's built to do all rendering with the Brigade path tracing renderer, which is a full CUDA GPU path tracer. And as you can see, you're getting pretty close to real-time results. There's still a little variance, but it smooths out in like under a second. And it's really cool stuff.
Do you know what hardware this is
running on? Oh yeah, I should mention that. So unfortunately, this particular demo is running on something like 4 GTX 680s or something ridiculous, right? But, you know, with the progression of graphics hardware and how graphics hardware just gets better and better every year, within a couple of years, this is going to be perfectly capable on, you know, your laptop. It'll be just running on everyday standard hardware,
which is pretty amazing.
I think it was running at something really bizarre, actually. It was running at, like, I don't remember the value, but it was like this really bizarre value that happened to optimize like the number of blocks that they were pushing at a given moment. Yeah, there's some weird stuff that you have to deal with in order to schedule things on the GPU, which we'll look into. And then the actual project that you guys will be building for Project 2, the path tracer, is based on a final project that Peter Kutz and I did last semester, and it looks kind of like this. Sorry, let me find. So it won't be quite as fast as Brigade, but it'll be running plenty fast. I think this is running on just one of the SIGLAB machines. So pretty like available hardware. And as you can see, we're getting full path tracing, and it's fast enough that you can interact with it, and it converges in, you know, a couple seconds. And after project two, every single one of you guys will have one of these as well. So that's going to be really cool. Okay. Oops. Sorry about that. Okay, so in order to implement parallel path tracing, we're first going to have to understand how to implement parallel ray tracing. Since path tracing is just an extension of ray tracing, it stands to reason that we need to understand ray tracing as a stepping stone. This is a really pretty picture that you can generate with just ray tracing. Okay, so the basic ray tracing algorithm we should all be very familiar with. We've seen it in 560. For each pixel inside of an image, you shoot a ray into the scene. For each ray, you trace it until it hits a surface. And then whenever it hits a surface at the intersection point, you cast a shadow feeler to every single light source to see whether or not that light source is occluded. And then if the light source is visible, you shade the point accordingly. If not, your point is in shadow. And then if the surface is diffuse, you can stop there, you're done. If the surface is reflective, you shoot a new ray off in the reflected direction across the normal from the incident ray, and then you repeat this over and over for each ray until you've reached your maximum tracing depth, and then you have your nice ray-traced image. So this algorithm should look really familiar to everyone. You've all implemented it before. This is the standard recursive ray tracing algorithm. It's very simple. You start off with a color, and you feed an array. If you know, you do an intersection test to see what the ray hits. If that surface is reflective, you call the function again, you recurse. If not, you check, or after that, you check the light sources, you do your light calculations and your light contribution, all that, and then you return a color. And then you just keep, this function calls itself over and over and over again to trace the ray for reflected surfaces. So parallelizing ray tracing is a really, really easy thing to do from a conceptual level. It's embarrassingly parallel, right? For every single pixel, you shoot a ray and you trace it. The result of one pixel does not depend on any other pixel inside of the scene, so why not just parallelize by pixel? You know, for each pixel that you have to trace, launch a thread. And you know, with our fancy GTX whatevers, you can now trace, or you can now have hundreds to thousands of threads in flight at the same time. So we can trace hundreds of thousands of pixels at the same time. And we can do this because each ray trace operation is not inherently expensive. Like, if you think about it, it's just an intersection test, and then a little bit of linear algebra to figure out the direction, and then adding up some colors, right? Those are really, really basic operations. So the actual complexity of each calculation is not very high. It's just there's a lot of calculations that we have to do. So if we have a lot of compute power to do those tons of calculations at the same time, then we can get a lot of speed. But wait, we have a problem. CUDA doesn't support recursion. How are we going to do this when we can't have functions call themselves? Except on Fermi and Neuwirth, but most people don't have that. So the answer is we're going to do iterative path tracing. So iterative path tracing is a slightly less intuitive approach to ray tracing. Oh, sorry, we're going to do iterative ray tracing. And the best way to think of it is kind of breadth-first search versus depth-first search. So do you guys all remember how to do breadth-first search versus depth-first search? Okay, so in depth-first search, you have your tree, and you go down, and you find, and you go back up, and you go down, and so on and so forth, right? So it's inherently recursive. For each node, you call some kind of search thing that goes through all of its children. Whereas for breadth-first search, you're exploring the tree in layers. You do the first layer, then you do the second layer, and do the third layer, and so on and so forth. So the recursive model looks like this. You trace all ray bounces in the first ray path, So, you know, bounce, 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 bounce. You do it for the second pixel. You do it for the third pixel, and so on and so forth. Okay, so for the iterative model, it's going to look like this. You trace the first ray bounce in all ray paths for all pixels. Then you do the second bounce for all pixels. You do the third bounce for all pixels, so on and so forth. So kind of resembles this. So how do you actually implement iterative ray tracing? Okay, well, if you can't call your, so if you can't call a function from within itself, how do you actually translate that into an iterative function? So from kind of basic algorithms classes, you guys probably remember that the first, you know, sort of the general gist of translating any recursive method or recursive algorithm into an iterative algorithm is to just convert it into a giant loop and then keep a bunch of state variables that keep track of what's going on between iterations of that loop, right? So we're doing the same thing here. We start off by storing the current ray and the current color, and then we go into this big loop that just loops for the until it hits the maximum ray tracing depth. And then inside of that loop, we do our standard ray tracing operations. We do our intersection test, we do our reflection test, and then what we do for the reflection is instead of, when we do have a reflective surface, instead of recursively calling, we calculate the new direction that the ray is going to go in, and we store it as current ray. That line is actually missing here. I'll fix the online slide stuff, reflect that. So you store the reflected ray as the current ray, so that the next time you go through this loop, you know what the ray that you need to follow is. And then you do your standard light calculation and color accumulation and all that. And then you just loop through here. And every single time, you're taking the ray that came out of the previous iteration and you're passing it into the next iteration. And that's how you're tracing it. And then when this is all finished, you return the color.
How about
refraction? So refraction is dealt with in the same exact way as reflection. I left that out so to keep it on the slide. It's just a second check. So you would have like a, you know, if object is reflective, and then right after that you could have else if object is refractive, and then you calculate the refractive ray direction.
So we have we just shoot a ray, then we get two ways, one reflection and one refraction ray.
Oh, that's a really good question. So in order to do things iteratively, you need to begin to do things also in a distributed fashion, sort of like multi passes. And so there are ways that you can kind of handle it within one pass, but the way that I suggest doing it and the way that it's going to actually make sense once we look at path tracing is that you can do something called Russian roulette. So the way Russian roulette works is when you come to a case where you have both refraction and reflection, you randomly select one of those to choose. Or you randomly choose one of those to follow. You randomly select either the refractive case or the reflective case, and then you follow that to its conclusion. And then you render the image again a second time. And then when you reach that point, you once again, you randomly select refractive or reflective. And you do this over and over, and you accumulate the result, and it'll converge onto the proper solution. And this is actually something that is very, very critical to how path tracing works. So, good question. Okay, so how are we going to implement this in a CUDA kernel? It seems pretty straightforward, right? Just dump the whole thing into a CUDA kernel and we're done, right? Anybody think we're done? Well, you could do this, but there's a couple of interesting optimizations and performance issues that we should look at. Okay, so how many bounces does each ray path make before terminating in order to trace this image? So say that this is your scene and you're shooting rays into this image, into this scene. How many bounces is each ray going to take? We have some diffuse surfaces, we have some reflective surfaces, we have just black backdrop, nothingness. Okay, so 4 bounces. Is it possible for rays to take 4 bounces? Sure. You hit a specular surface every time, and then eventually you hit a diffuse surface. It could take 3 bounces. You could bounce twice, hit a diffuse surface, and you're done. You could do 2 bounces. 1 bounce is possible. Or you could just shoot into the void and have no bounces. So what we can conclude from this is that for a given scene, we actually have no idea how many bounces each ray path may have to take before finishing and returning a color. So what does this uncertainty imply about parallelizing the rays? Anybody?
Boundary synchronized sets if one goes like 5 and one goes nothing.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't know when things are going to terminate, which means we need to wait for the last ray to finish tracing, which means potentially we have a lot of wasted cycles. So it's just like in this diagram. Let's say that you have 6 threads, and each thread is tracing a different pixel, right? So let's say the first thread is in this worst case scenario and has to do 4 bounces. And each thread is tracing an entire pixel to the very end because we're parallelizing by pixels. So the second thread, it's done after the first bounce. The third one, it shoots into nothingness. It's been done the whole time. So, and so on and so forth, right? So we're wasting a lot of cycles. A lot of these threads are just idling and doing nothing because they finished a long time ago. So the conclusion that we can get from this is that while parallelizing by pixels will get you an image, it's not necessarily the best approach. In fact, it's a fairly naive approach. So the solution to this is parallelized by rays, not pixels. So instead of having a single kernel launch, where you just launch all the pixels at the same time and you wait for them to all finish, what you can do instead is have each thread do one bounce for one ray and then finish, right? So the way that you do this is you begin by constructing a pool of rays that you need to trace. So instead of having like a pool of pixels that you need to trace, you now have a pool of rays. And then you also have a pool of your colors that you're tracing and stuff. And then for each kernel launch, instead of tracing a pixel and all of the bounces inside of that pixel to its very end, you just trace a single bounce. And then you have all the kernels return. And you also have them record whether or not their array needs to be traced again, or whether it's going off into nothing, or whether it's finished. And then once you've done that and gotten all that information back, you can remove all the terminated rays and all the terminated pixels from this ray pool using an algorithm similar to string compaction, which is something that Patrick will go over inside of the CUDA algorithms lecture later on. So, and then you repeat this process over and over for each iteration. So basically, instead of, if we go all the way back and look at the algorithm, instead of wrapping this whole thing into a CUDA kernel, you're only taking the inside of the of that loop, of that for loop. And then the inside of the for loop is the kernel. And then you're executing that loop by launching kernels over and over again. And this way, every time that you come across a ray that no longer needs to be traced, you can remove it from the list of rays that you have to trace. And that way you can guarantee that you're only tracing rays that will actually matter. So if you think about this in terms of like blocks, right? It means that each iteration that you're tracing will require fewer blocks than the previous iteration because rays are terminating with each iteration of this iterative process. And that means that we can actually get better performance. Because if you think about like, you know, the first iteration, let's say that you have a case where you have 10 blocks and they're executing in groups of 4, right? So how many batches of blocks do you have to execute? You have to execute 3. So that's, you know, so that's like 3 times as many cycles as the second iteration. So let's say in the second iteration, you've now eliminated a whole bunch of rays that don't need to be traced. They're all going off into space, like in that example picture. So if we do this compaction on the ray pool, we now have a lot less rays. And since we have a lot less rays, we need a lot less threads, which means we need a lot fewer blocks, which means that we can potentially have just 4 blocks, and since we can launch 4 blocks at a time, you know, we're golden. The second iteration will take 1/3 of the time the first one did. And this keeps on going for each further iteration. However, there's a couple of edge cases where this may not provide a performance boost. So can any of you guys have any ideas of what those cases might be? Yeah, exactly. So if all of your surfaces are purely reflective, then you don't have any choice but to trace your rays to the very end. However, as you can see looking around this room, I'm pretty sure most of the surfaces in here are not purely reflective. And so if you're trying to render a realistic image, the case where you have a room full of mirrors is actually a fairly rare edge case. So in the vast majority of cases, this will give you a pretty significant performance boost. So super simple example. We have our scene again with a lot of empty space. So we're just going to look at these three rays. So the first kernel launch, the ray pool contains these three rays. They're all being cast from the camera. We have no idea where they're going. We have no idea what their contribution is. So we have to trace them. So we need three threads. And then at the end of that iteration, the ray one, which is the red one, has gone off into space. And it's terminated. We don't need to worry about it anymore. So we remove that from the ray pool. So for the second set of kernel launches, we only need to trace two rays. So we only need two threads. Trace them, see where they go. Third kernel launch, still two rays because they both bounced. We still need two threads. But at the end of this, we find that the ray three has terminated because it's hit a diffuse surface. So we remove it from the ray pool. And now, on the fourth kernel launch, we only need to trace one ray. So we only need one thread. And then, since it also hits a diffuse surface, we can remove that from the ray pool as well, and then we're done. So as you can see, instead of tracing three rays on this iteration, we're just tracing one. Okay, so there's a couple of other quirks that are associated with trying to build a parallel ray tracer using CUDA. So assuming that we CUDA memcopy all of our geometry and materials in the scene from our host, where we've built our scene and or loaded it from a file or whatever, it's going to be sitting all in the device global memory, right? Okay, so what happens in this scene on the first bounce in terms of memory? In terms of memory access, all the rays are going into the scene and hitting the same objects, right?
Is it the same for all
the rays? Yes. In fact, it's a case that keeps happening. But there's a special case about the first bounce. Okay, so the point that I think you're trying to get to is that you're going to have a lot of rays trying to access a lot of the same pieces of geometry and memory, which means you're going to be thrashing your memory reads, right? They're all going to be trying to access the same location in memory. Okay, so that's bad. We have a lot of memory reads that are required. sort of memory performance, is that something that we...
A little bit.
Okay, yeah, so basically you're going to get into stuff like partition camping and like that's what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, stuff like that, which... you'll learn about. Basically, you're just trying to read a whole bunch of stuff, and memory bandwidth isn't high enough to supply all of that information fast enough. So, as Chazan pointed out, this is going to be the case every single iteration, because every single ray bounce has to hit geometry that's in your scene, right? However, there's a very special case about the first set of ray bounces that none of the other sets of ray bounces further on have, which is that the first set of ray bounces is always the same, because you're always just raycasting from the camera. So one thing that you can do to get a bit of a performance boost is you can cache that entire first set of ray passes. You can have a separate kernel that launches, that does your camera raycast, and then you can store that result. And then you can just use that result, that set of rays, to launch all future iterations and all future versions of your distributed ray tracing solution. And sorry, what? Okay, so in order to kind of semi-alleviate the problem of trying to concurrently access all the geometry in your scene in memory at the same time from all rays, what you can do is you can have a separate kernel, which is just the camera, that just does the camera raycast. And then, because those rays will always be the same, the first bounce of rays coming from the camera are always the same. In fact, I believe that's how your Project One framework is set up, is that the camera raycast is a separate kernel from the ray tracer itself. So what you can do is you do that initial raycast, and then you cache the results. You store it somewhere inside of memory, and then in the future when you need to do a second frame or a second iteration or whatever of your ray traced image, whenever you need to do that initial raycast again, instead of having to do it again, you can refer back to what you stored.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean store the results? What are we storing? Are we storing the position setting or the color?
You're storing the rays. So all the first set of ray casts. So for each pixel, you're storing an origin and a direction.
Okay.
for the ray coming out of the camera. And you can also, if you wanted, you could actually also store the like the surface that it hits, you know, what the material properties of that surface is. If it's diffuse, you can store the, or sorry, if it's reflective, you can store the reflection direction. Like how you choose to cache this first pass, you can get pretty creative with.
So how can it be cached?
Yeah, you just make an array in global memory and you keep it there.
But then we still have to access global memory.
But the point is that each thread will be accessing one unique index inside of this array, and you won't have a whole bunch of threads accessing the same in like block of indices. Or same block of memory. Yeah, and the term that's kind of thrown around, sorry, what's that? Okay, the term that's kind of thrown around in the industry for this is first bounce cache, second bounce thrash. First bounce, you cache it, you store it, don't worry about it. Second bounce, it's gonna thrash your memory access and there's not a lot you can do about it. However, if your scene is sufficiently small, you could try storing everything inside of shared memory. However, this could be a bad idea, and you guys can probably guess why. You know, if your scene is too large to fit inside a shared memory, then you will have to do a lot of really fancy swapping out parts of your scene into shared memory and parts of it out, or you just can't do it at all. And considering how small shared memory is, it's pretty easy to overflow that size. Okay, so that's all that I have for you guys today, and we're wrapping up right on time.
So who has the first question for Carl?
Yeah, any questions?
So my question is, based on your discussion today, what would you emphasize as your biggest tip for Project One?
Okay, so for Project One, you have two options for implementing it. You can either implement it using the pixel parallelization or the ray parallelization. And right now, inside of the framework, I don't actually suggest which one you should pick. It's sort of up to you. However, if I were you, I would implement the ray parallelization. It's a little more complex because you need to figure out how to keep track of all of those rays between kernel launches. But it's something that will yield a really large performance boost. And it's something that when it comes to path tracing, when we do the path tracing discussion on Wednesday, you'll see why it's helpful.
So you're saying between Project 1 and Project 2, you'll have less overall work?
Exactly. If you do the ray parallelization this time around, you'll have slightly less work to do. And you'll probably need some information on how to do, like, string compaction with Thruster yourself. So I can post that to Piazza.
Yes, we need a cover parallel algorithm, so
yeah.
It's a little slightly out of order, I guess, with that.
Yeah.
We'll let you guys cover.
Yeah.
Are you expected to use shared memory?
I would say for the ray tracer, no. Carl, you're the one that's...
if you are... So you're not expected to, because you're not expected to necessarily have scenes that can fit entirely inside of shared memory. However, if you want to try to do that, if you want to try to figure out how to either store the entire scene in shared memory or some way to swap parts into shared memory as needed. If you can figure out how to do that, I think we can accept that as one of the like optional features in addition to the list that's there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely we can do that. And we're not the whole point of this course is that you get a lot of project experience and then you have these projects to show people afterwards. And we have all these things that hey, implement three of these or two of these. And if you have something else, ask us, but the most likely answer is yeah, go ahead and do that instead if you're passionate about it. So. Other questions for Carl?
So how do we parallelize the second stage of second kernel launch for the reflected phase?
Same way that you do it for the first. Because
it was just pixel in the first case.
Yeah, so if we go back to okay, so what's happening is you're storing like the ray that's the result of each iteration, right? So you treat the reflected ray case exactly the same as the initial ray cast or an refracted ray or whatever. You don't really care what type of ray it is, you just know it's a ray. And that's all you really need to know. Because if you think about the recursive case, that's also what's happening. When you recurse on the ray trace function, you're passing it in a ray direction without actually giving it information about what type of ray it is. So when you parallelize like by rays, you don't really care what type of ray it is. So you can treat all ray trace operations, each bounce you can treat exactly the same as all the other ones. So the first set of bounces you can treat the same as the second set of bounces and the same as the third and so on and so forth.
Any other questions?
So you start out and you do the initial one and then you call all the ones that don't bounce and you keep the ones that are bouncing. Would it make sense once you get down to some fraction of your original number of rays to kind of pipeline it and send out the next iteration before you finish the previous iteration? Like if you have a bunch of rays that are bouncing like 8 or 9 times and then like the majority of the scene is just hitting that wall, you could probably plow through like 8 or 9 iterations and converge on the wall pixels faster than the mirror wall pixels.
Yeah, you probably could.
That's sort of getting into
the idea of importance sampling, which is like just figuring out which parts of your image are going to require more work to converge and finish. And so for those parts of your image, you just prioritize for like computation. I haven't implemented that myself in CUDA, so I'm not entirely sure of the details of how you go about doing that. But
we encourage you to try.
Yeah, feel free to give it a shot, and if you do, let me know how it goes.
So in this case, if we do ray-wise parallelization, there is some saving in terms of processing. So in this case, we are just doing ray tracing, so it might matter if we do pixelization. Because even if some cycles are wasted, there is nothing that we are going to do in the same cycle, right? In this project.
Yeah, like if you want to do the ray tracer with just pixel parallelization, you can.
In this case, it won't have any performance.
Well, Yes, you're right. Yeah.
Okay, so since
unless you start doing distributed cases like soft shadows and area lights, because in those cases you're doing multiple renders of the same frame and accumulating them. So in those cases it will have a impact, but if you're just doing straight ray tracing without any sort of distributed stuff, then yeah, you're right.
So let's handle any other questions up front so you guys have time to see Pixar if you want to, and we'll see you on Wednesday.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you, guys.
Oh, hey,
yes. What's up?
How to store the return value of the second iteration?